Accession number 9168, rule number 3.
Mr. Emmat, rule 3. When you went over the top for the first time and you went into the shell hole and your friend was killed, did you stay there?
No. About 5 minutes afterwards, first of all, I turned him over a bit to make sure what was happening, and I more or less knew from my medical knowledge that he was dead. And then I crawled up the rim of the shell hole to look around, and I saw a couple of officers who'd just come up, and they asked me what had happened, and I told them, and they said I was to join another party that had come up from reserve trenches, not our own regiment, but another one. And from there, the sergeant major told us to start digging trenches facing where we were a bit advanced, which we did. And eventually, some tools came up, some picks and shovels. Otherwise, we were digging with our entrenching tools, which we always carried with us. And we started digging these line of trenches. And I don't remember rightly, but we must have spent that night there. And the following day, we went over the top again. But this time, it was a different... We didn't meet this machine gun fire like we did before, but we met with shell fire. But it seemed to come to nothing from my angle. I couldn't see what was more or less what was happening. I only saw one or two Germans, and they were firing a gun all hundreds of yards away. But the action was so mixed that it was difficult to remember what happened. But I know the action was terminated, and we were all relieved by another county regiment. I don't know whether it was the Warwicks or one of the Midland regiments, anyway. And when we came back, and that's where it took me all that time to get back after helping with a stretcher bearing, and eventually arrived at our bivouacs at Trones Wood, which we'd left a couple of days before.
When you were digging the advanced trench, were you under fire?
Oh, yes. Not necessarily odd rifle shots, no machine guns this time, but shell fire. What we used to call whiz-bangs, they were the field artillery shells, like our 18-pounders, and they high-velocity shells, and then you more or less... The explosion occurred about the same time as you heard the whistle. So that's what they call whiz-bangs, you think. But
had the training that you'd received prepared you for this type of action?
What?
Had the training, how adequate had the training been for this first action?
Training? Mm. Well, no training at all. You just have to take it as it comes. But we're all more or less... given various versions of this. You see, what they used to do is all the old soldiers, who, especially the NCOs who'd been up the front before, used to attend all these drafts and give them a lecture on what they expect when they got up there, you see. So we more or less knew what to expect, although we actually didn't experience it, you see. Oh, it was a terrifying time, no doubt about it. I mean... When I look back, I was 18 then, just turned 18, you see, a young lad of 18 to face all those, that difficult period. And I mean, the casualties I saw was terrific. The night we went up on that Leboeuf, the 8th of October, as we went towards the front line, there was literally hundreds of bodies you passed of all different regiments. You could tell by their uniforms and regalia what they were laying on the ground. And that was that had occurred, you see, on the first few days of those July advances. The trouble was, you see, the guns never broke the wire at all. And our troops that went over were caught trying to get through the wire while Germans were machine gunning us from vantage points all along the front, you see. That's where the casualties occurred.
How much ground did you actually make on that first?
Oh, not more than a quarter of a mile, I suppose. 300 or 400 yards at the outset. And that's how they used to do it. Make, in those, if I remember rightly, the order was in those days that a regiment went up, took over at midnight a stretch of front line, went over the top the following morning or afternoon, consolidated with another advanced trench, got relieved that night or the following night, and then the other regiment done the same. So they were going like that all the time. Of course, thousands of casualties just for the sake of a few hundred yards of ground, you see.
How did you feel when you went over the top for the first time?
Terrified. I had no idea what I was going to do or if I met a German or anything. Although we'd been trained to, you see. But after my friend was killed, I took a different attitude and I would have certainly taken very severe action if I'd have met a German.
Did you actually meet any?
Not actually face to face in those days. But I did later on. The only thing about the Germans was the fact that I used to be in all sorts of spots where he was shelling a machine gun, and I happened to be one of the lucky ones who got away with it.
Did you have the opportunity for any rest between your first and second?
Yes, oh yes.
Time's over.
Yeah, we went after we'd left Trones Wood, after Lebeuf's, that was the name of the action we were in, on the 8th and 9th of October. And after we left there, we went on these French buses, and they took us, I forget now, it was, must have been up towards Arras somewhere that way, on a 3 weeks rest. And that's what you did, you see. You'd done a certain number of days, up to about a week or even a fortnight, up the front, in action and all that, and out of action and in action. Then you came back and had 2 or 3 weeks rest in a what's called a divisional area. That was 3 or 4 miles behind the lines, you see, but more or less under German shell fire, but not actually in any immediate danger. And then you went up the line again after you, when you were in these rest periods, you were re-equipped, retrained, as it were, and then all the new drafts used to come in and join you to make the strength up, you see. But that action where I was in, where I came out at Lebeuf's, there was 140 in my company, and on that roll call, muster roll call, I was the only one who had been company that was on parade. There's several others joined us later who'd lost their way like I had, you see, but it was only about half a dozen of us. All the rest were either killed, wounded or missing. But the other companies didn't suffer the same as we did, because we were the ones who went over the top first of all and took the brunt of the action. The other companies were kept in reserve and sort of pushed on after us, but they still suffered. We lost nearly half the battalion, I think, on those 2 days.
What about your officers? Did you lose your officers?
Very few left. We lost, all our officers in our company. And I don't know about the other companies, because we weren't kept more or less in touch with them. But on reading about it afterwards, I found out that there was quite a number of... 3 parts of the officers were killed or wounded in that action. So we went from our rest period and went up to a place called Levante, which was on the Labassi front. That's up near Ypres. And here, this was getting on towards November time, we manned the trenches at a place called Neuve Chapelle, which was the scene of a battle the year before.
How did you travel?
By French bus, by train, and all sorts of transport that was available in those days. It was and of course you had to march quite a lot as well, because there were so many soldiers and so much going on that I don't know how they organised any transport at all, really. Anyway, we eventually arrived at this place, and we were billeted in this little village which was near Neuve Chapelle. It was called Ville Chapelle. And that's where the year before the Gurkhas had lost 800 men when they went over the top after the battle. That's only by the way, though. Anyway, we were billeted in empty cottages that were, they'd been broken down with shell fire and all derelict. And anyway, it was a bit of a shelter. And we stayed there and used to run the line and do 4 or 5 days and nights up in the front line trench, then come back and do 4 or 5 days in the reserve trench and so on. And while I was there, one thing I remember about it is that you couldn't dig trenches because it was all canals and low-lying ground. So what they'd done was they filled sandbags with earth and made breastworks all the way along the front. And you sunk up to your ankles in water and mud every time you went up the front line and stood there. Quite a life it was, really, because it was getting on winter time and your feet felt frozen because we didn't have gum boots in those days. We only had army boots and putties. And eventually you did get a few duck boards there. And I remember while I was there one night, I'd just come off duty from the fire step, had been relieved by another soldier, went into a bit of a bivouac that they'd made with a few old corrugated iron sheets stretched over some sandbags, with a few empty sandbags on the floor to lie on or rest on. Anyway, the duties we had were arduous, and you soon went to sleep. You didn't worry about, just as soon as you laid down, you dropped off to sleep. And anyway, I got in this place after I'd been relieved, and I went to sleep, and then I woke up, must have been the middle of the, after I'd been there about an hour or so, I put my hand down. You had to keep all your equipment and clothes on, you know, while you were there. The only thing you do is you just loosen your belt of your equipment. And I put my hand down on the left-hand side of your equipment, you had your haversack. And behind that was the bayonet scabbard. Anyway, I put my hand down and I felt something move at the side of my haversack. And a bit of a scuttle, a rat had eaten his way through in my haversack and started eating my rations. There were plenty of rats about. You could hear them squealing all night. The chaps used to amuse themselves chasing them with a rifle and bayonet. We had a bit of snow up there just before I was taken out of that line. And very quiet it was after I'd sojourned on the Somme. Hardly any shots fired. And it was more or less a no-go area. And there was a unwritten law, as it were, that if you don't fire at us, we won't fire at you. And somebody at higher-up suggested that we liven things up, so they started organising raiding parties. And I remember this time it was snowing, and got this raiding party together. There was no question of volunteers. They just simply said, you, and you, and that was it. You were one of the party. And they got sheets off the hospital, a local hospital, white sheets, cut holes in them, and the chap put them in through the holes so that all the sheet covered the rest of their body. And they they went over the top. Of course, on a raiding party, normally you'd go quietly and you'd creep out one by one through a hole in the wire and creep over towards the Jerry lines, you see, and that's what they did. I wasn't in the party at the time, so I was on sentry on the fire step, and I could see these people crawling through the wire and out into no man's land across the Jerry lines with their sheets on. And anyway, they got tumbled. Somebody must have been very alert in the German lines, and they started firing at them, and our party had to scuttle back. I remember one of the chaps who we used to know very well, he was one of the comics of the party, and he got away from the rest of them, lost his way somewhere, and got landed up in front of another regiment altogether. Anyway, a sentry challenged him. He said, "Who's there?" And this chap shouted out, "Oh, it's only Collard." That was his name, you see. And this bloke, he said, "I don't know who the hell Collard is. Come up and let me identify you." Anyway, he got away with it. But soon after that, getting on towards Christmas, on this routine sentry business we used to do, holding these lines, a sergeant and an officer came along one day and asked me what my name was, and I told him. They said, "You're wanted in the OC's office, so you get relieved and go and report them." I went back there, and an officer said to me, asked me what my name was, and all particulars to identify him, and he gave me a note in an envelope and told me to leave the office and go to a place about 3 miles away. And when I got there and delivered this note, I found out afterwards that what had happened is my mother and father had written to the war office telling them that I was underage, and that I had to, and in those days you weren't allowed to go in action unless you were 19, you see. So I was only 18, so they took me out of the line and put me back into a more or less a base area. Well, it wasn't a base area, it was only just behind the line. A place called Merrifield. And from there I was more or less engaged in fatigue duties and all sorts of jobs. I waited in the officer's mess and all sorts of jobs like that.
Did you know your parents were going to write?
Become?
Did you know your parents were going to write?
No. I had a shock of my life, and I was very pleased when I got taken out of the line. No, I didn't know, but I found out afterwards that my father's employer had more or less got onto somebody in the war office, and they told him that as I was underage, I weren't allowed to be in action with the army until I was 19, you see. So also I was only just 18 and a half. So I got back and spent some days or some weeks really in this rear area, and from there I was sent to back up to Le Havre again, the base. And I spent I must have spent Christmas, I think. I spent Christmas at this place, Merrifield, and after Christmas in the winter I was sent back to Le Havre, and I stopped there until I was 19.
How had the army reacted to knowing that you'd lied about your age?
Oh, I didn't take no notice. There was thousands of us. I found that afterwards. And after my career in the army, after that, I joined they made battalions up of us people, and they called us the immatures. and they were all sort of banded together, all more or less the same age. Some of them younger than I was, and they made old units up with them, and these units were used as training units on some of the officers' training courses. The officers used to leave the liner on a course, perhaps for about 2 or 3 weeks, you see, and these immature people, were used as like a force to be ordered about by these officers to show them how actions take place up the front and all that sort of thing. You see, you used to have to disperse and advance and all that under orders from these officers while they were on this course. You know?
Whilst you were in the trenches, what rations did you receive?
Ah, yeah. We were pretty well fed, really, but we had bully beef that was in cans or tins, and we had McConaughey rations. That was the name of an American firm who supplied this, and they were all sorts of English dishes like steak and kidney pudding and steak and kidney pie and all that sort of thing, all in tins. And then we had white bread, if you were anywhere near a bakery. Otherwise, you always fell back on army biscuits. That was a hard biscuit made very much like a dog biscuits were, of a mixture of meat extract, flour, and all that sort of thing. And the biscuit was about 4 inches square and about half inch thick, and very hard to bite on, but very sustaining. You always carry two of those, plus a little bag of tea and sugar, a small tin, like a mustard tin. In there was a tea and sugar mixed, two biscuits, and a tin of bully beef. That was your iron rations, in case you got separated, you see, and you couldn't get anywhere near any cookhouse or form of food that was going. Mostly we managed to get our rations, but they also had a container, like a thermos flask, a large thing that was placed on the back of a soldier and held about 5 or 6 gallons of stew or tea or whatever it was they put in it, you see. And that used to be carried up the front by the soldier, so that and dished out when you got in the trenches, you see, to every one of us.
Could you light any fires?
Well, no, you weren't allowed any fires at all, no form of light at all, but what they used to do was, They'd use charcoal, which was, of course, more or less smokeless during the day. But at night, they'd put a corrugated iron sheets over the top of a trench and a couple of blankets down the side and light a fire to brew up the tea or cook whatever meal was going, you see. But never during the day or never at night that was any light was showing at all. This was usually done 2 or 3 miles away. It had to be carried up to the trenches, you see.
How long did you have to go on sentry duty for?
Well, you usually done 2 hours on, and according to the number of people who were in the bay at the time, you see. If there was 6 of you, you see, you'd do a 3 series. You do, there'd be 2 of you on duty, standing on the fire step, and then 4 of you sitting or lying down in the trench resting, you see, and you took it in turns. You had 2 on and 4 off right throughout the whole 24 hours. But then you had to, every morning at dawn and every evening at dusk, you all had to stand too for half an hour. That's everybody was lying the fire step with a rifle slung over the top ready, and twice a day you done that, morning and evening, you see. The Germans used to do the same because we used to see them. And that was the time when it was most dangerous, when any attack would occur because it was between the lights, you see.
Did the Germans send out raiding parties as well?
Did they what?
Did they send out raiding parties?
Oh, yes, yes. We used to often have to open fire, but we never used to ask any questions, nor did they. If you saw a movement out in front, you just simply acquainted the officer or the NCO in the trench who was in charge, and you'd all man the trench and fire rounds, whatever object was indicated, you see. There was no questions asked about that at all.
What about bringing your wounded back in?
No, that was quite a job because nobody gave any quarter, especially some of the fiercest battles. And just to show your head above the trench or above a shell hole, you'd be a dead man in no time. So very difficult. And whoever used to do these jobs deserved the decoration they used to get. Terrible job going out in no man's land, bringing wounded back. But as it got dark, so parties used to go out with stretcher bearers and pick up these wounded, you see, and bandage them up and tie and bring them back, you see. Talking about bandaging, we always, in our tunics, we always carried a first aid packet, which was a couple of 2-inch wide bandages and a little glass vial of iodine and or something else, I forget now what it was, or a couple of pads of lint, so that if anybody was wounded, or yourself even, you could apply some form of dressing on them. But this idea of putting iodine on was discounted off us because they found it done more harm than good. Although it killed germs, it also armed the person concerned.